The draft is where the league's future stars are born, and the foundation for future championships is set.
Welcome to a new episode of What's on Draft. I'm here with Cole Swicker. Mark Whittington can't join us for this one, and I know he probably wanted to discuss. We are very much going to go in depth about the trade that just basically happened. It's going to be official supposedly on Monday, so we're recording on Sunday right now. But what are your first impressions, Cole? Like, we didn't really expect anything to get done this early, or not even like before the day of the draft, so it's just quite a shocker, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a total headliner for what usually transpires the weekend before the draft. We rarely see the number one pick get moved, so really intriguing stuff as far as, you know, Boston's mindset, how they're going to approach this as far as, are they going to move pick number three now? What are they thinking as far as free agency goes? So it's a pretty loaded question.
Yeah, it's like, it's complex in too many levels because you have to analyze from the salary cap perspective as well. Like you were saying with free agency, like even if they want to move this pick for another asset or if they want to keep it, like just by the fact that they're lower to the third slot, they're going to have a little bit more cap space. And if the cap rises a little bit above where we expect, there is a $101 million, they might even have enough to just sign outright Gordon Hayward without parting with any more talent. That was part of the argument there. Like they didn't want to get rid of any of their players that they value, and they were like in place that they needed to do that if they kept the number one selection, just because the max for Hayward is a bit rich compared to what they have under the books. So like that could be an angle here as well, if they know that could be a possibility for them. But just if we are talking about like basically the nitty-gritty of the draft, like they got the third selection from Philadelphia, and supposedly either the 2018 selection from the Lakers protected 1 and 6 to 30. That means that it only goes to the Celtics if the pick falls into the second to fifth area. And if not, they are getting the Sacramento pick in 2019 unprotected, I suppose. We don't have a lot of information on that, but that would be my guess. I don't know if you feel like the trade is fair. I think if like when everything was going on, that was like Friday night, I was like super tired. I thought like if the Sixers were both including the Lakers and the Kings pick, that was a bit too rich for me. But then this solution makes more sense for them than I would have guessed otherwise.
I guess it all comes down to how you view Markelle Fultz as like a number one pick talent, bird in hand type. If you don't think that he is the best talent in this draft and in a separate tier, I really get that for Boston as far as moving down to three and then getting potentially, you know, equity at Michael Porter Jr. next year, that kind of type. If you assume that Doncic goes number one and then potentially being the Kings pick in 2019 unprotected, which has a lot of value because the Kings don't project to be any good. They don't have any like fixtures on their roster that would indicate otherwise. So I think it's a more fair deal than it's given probably credit for. I love the deal for Philadelphia. I mean, that's really the main takeaway here. Boston has too much uncertainty to really have like a steadfast opinion at this juncture. But Philadelphia, man, they move up. They take Markelle Fultz. Likely, I mean, he's going to be the pick, and it fits just wonderfully with their core, in my opinion. They double down on primary initiator equity, so now they're not basically pigeonholing themselves into Ben Simmons as their primary creator. So I really like what they did. The cost wasn't that high, in my opinion. I mean, protecting next year's pick, number one, was huge. I mean, we just seen the value of number one picks. This could be one of the most valuable number one picks in 2018 that we've had in a while, depending on who you like there. But it looks like a high upside pick. So I really like what they did. They protected themselves to a certain extent, and they get the best prospect in this class, in my opinion.
Yeah, not putting their stems in a hole in terms of future assets makes a lot of sense for me. Like, even if you believe that Simmons is going to be a superstar or Embiid is going to be that, like, it's good to have more options there. Like, you never know what's going to go with them. And even if Embiid has, like, a lackluster career just because of injuries or anything like that, like, we don't wish that on him. But, like, if that happens, you at least have a backup plan that might make sense if Simmons or Fultz or both get to that level of a player. So I think that's a really good point there. And also, there is something to be said about, like, grooming all your guys at the same time, having them already in place. I think that makes tons of sense for them just to get like everything going quicker. And you have to consider that maybe Embiid's prime is not going to be as long as other guys just because of the injury concerns. Like, so you might have like an open window to be a contender sooner rather than later, and it might close sooner than with other top prospects. So like you might want to get ready to be competitive as soon as possible there also. I think that's a fair point to be made there. And I like the protections they have. Like, at least if the pick is the number one, like, historically, like, you look at the numbers and all that, like, the most of the All-Stars, most of the franchise players come from that selection. I mean, we have had some busts and all that, but like most of the cases, like, that's why, that's one of the arguments against Boston here, right? Like, the guys are real consensus number one, even if you don't like him all that much, like, that normally turns out to be, like, a pretty good player overall. So, like, it just depends with Boston. I think it depends a lot on the criteria that they use for making this trade. Like, if the criteria is related to the what they have in the roster right now, I would think that that's a mistake. If the criteria is like they don't really believe in Fultz for whatever reason and they want to take another player, for sure, it's better to move down and get another asset in the way. So we don't really know about that. Like you said, there is a lot going on with them, and I don't think you can really judge the move unless you see where are they going to do with the pick first and then with the free agency period and which direction are they going with this team. But like, overall, I mean, it seems a bit like a move that you are moving back just to get more time, basically, and get a bit more like room to operate in the future. But that's fine if you don't like Fultz all that much. Like, it's just, at least you are getting some value there. It's better than taking another guy than Fultz at first.
I totally agree with that. And I think just to quickly hit on Philadelphia to wrap them up, I mean, their young core is one of the best we've seen organically, at least talent on paper, in a long time. I mean,
Since the Thunder, kind of.
Exactly. Yeah. Oklahoma City is really the only kind of talent level that rose to this level. I mean, I don't think any of these prospects has Durant value and equity, but as far as conducive fit, they all provide something different. I think there was a notion going around Twitter last night that the fit wasn't ideal. Fultz needs the ball. I don't agree with that sentiment. I think that Fultz is optimized on the ball, but he can also play off the ball and have value there. Yeah. And you have at least one initiator now at all times of the game. I mean, when Simmons sits, you're going to have Fultz running the offense. You can run it through Embiid. It's just, there's a lot of versatility on that roster. They have Covington, who fits beautifully next to those guys as a wing defender. If TLC evolves into a good shooter, I think he fits well in that core too, as far as being able to defend the point of attack, spacing the ball off ball, allowing Markel to utilize his length and strength more, guarding two guards to conserve his energy. So there's just a lot of moving parts in this roster. They still have Dario in like an ideal six man, like, I don't, this is kind of a lazy comp, but like in a Lamar Odom kind of role, right? He comes off the bench, he gives you matchup versatility, he can play make a little bit as a playmaking four. So this is a really
he can play some five for you too.
Yes, it's a really,
he can
really
play some
enticing
small five. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really enticing combination of talent and young talent at that. I'm not sure how they're going to be able to sign everybody, but I mean, that's a problem for later down the road as far as, you know, can this team stay healthy and stuff. But this is one of the reasons that you watch the NBA during the regular season is for young talent like this.
Yeah, like I was making the point before, I did another podcast in Spanish and the question was like, is going to be a problem with the shooting ability and all that? Like if you have another shooter other than the four that we're considering starters with Fultz, Simmons, Covington and Embiid, like you can just use Simmons as the role man also. Like if the problem is that, you can just have pick and roll with Simmons and Fultz, you can have Embiid space in the floor for you, you can have another two shooters in Covington and your other guard, and you're fine there. Like try to stop Simmons with a four going to the rim in terms of like being able to exploit there. And if you put a big on him, you can have him dribble over the big. Like what are you going to do there? Like that's a mismatch already. Like that's the situation for me that I find pretty exciting. Like you can just, if you get to build chemistry between those three guys, like you can just have so many options offensively to just build up any type of situation where you can have a mismatch that is incredible valuable today in the NBA. And you have guys like Embiid, like if you are going to put a quicker guy on him so they can just go and cover them in the perimeter, he's going to be able to posterize that guy and just bully them inside. So it's just like you have so many options, and if you have enough in terms of like chemistry and in terms of like sets, I think you can just get a good basket here and there most of the time there. So just, that's just like, I mean, it's a perfect core to me. If you surround them with a couple shooters, they have one already that I think is valuable in Covington. But like, if they add another guy on the wing, like could be, that could be one of their own guys that they can groom, or they can be just a guy that's signed because they have enough cap space for a couple of years now. So just so many options there, man. Like it could be really, really exciting.
Yeah, I think for free agency implications, it probably takes Kyle Lowry off the table. You're not going to max him and play him next to Fultz. Likely, there's just not enough on-ball equity to go around now. Mm-hmm. But a guy like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, man, I would throw max money in him. He's an ideal fit. So if you can get him,
but like even if
no, go ahead.
I was thinking even if you go on the cheap and you sign a CJ Miles or something like that, like that's a guy that can help. Maybe it's just a guy that you can sign for like a couple of years, $8 million a year or something. Like he's a better shooter than Gerald Henderson. That can be a guy that can be a fit there and defend a bit of the two, defend a bit of the three, depending on where you're putting Covington at. He can cover wings and guards also. Like he saw that last year. So like that's another thing. You have like Covington and Embiid to cover a little bit for Fultz if Fultz is going to be at the in the defensive end. So, like, I think it's a perfect situation for Fultz as well to grow up as a guy and grow up as a prospect. Like, the situation, they can run in transition as well with, like, the system that Brett Brown likes and with Simmons being a monster in that area. It's just so much versatility. It's like, it's really difficult to defend if they actually all pan out to the degree we think they can.
Yeah, I think the overarching takeaway is that they have their primaries now, and it's very rare to have a team that has their primary guys and they can start building around them. They now have their three fixtures moving forward. We'll see how they maintain health-wise, but as far as just on-ball creation, two-way play, they have enough to go around that you rarely see from a team this age. But let's get into a little bit more Boston. For me, again, this is an indicator that they didn't value Fultz as highly in this class. Maybe that's the wrong way to read this, but I thought trading down to three, normally that number one pick has incredible value in hand, because it's so hard to come by, right? Like, we rarely see the number one pick moved. It has a ton of value historically as far as, you know, acquiring the top echelon talent. So what do you think their mindset is here? Do you think they go Tatum or Jackson? We see a lot of Tatum rumors. Do you want to address that?
I don't really see, like, I know people have said that he makes sense with Jaylen Brown. I know people are thinking about Jaylen Brown more of a guy that is going to be a grab-and-go guy and all that, but I thought in the mid-range, he liked to operate in the mid-range in California. I know probably he's not going to be able to do all that in the NBA, but I thought he likes similar spots on the floor that Tatum likes, like in the mid-post and things like that. Of course, Tatum is more skilled and has a better shooting touch and stuff like that, but, like, I don't see it all that well, and I see it probably even worse with Jackson. It's just, like, how long is Ainge going to take similar? I know they are not the same and they are different positions, but, like, guys that are more or less aggressive on ball, guys that show their emotions and they are, like, kind of, like, all day, every day motor on the court, like Marcus Smart before in 2014, Jaylen Brown last year, a little bit like that as well, Josh Jackson this year. I know he likes those guys. I just don't see it, man. Like, if I were them, I know part of the argument that was made from one of these Boston Globe columnists, I can't really recall the name, was that they didn't want to crowd the backcourt even more, and I thought that was a foolish argument. I hope that's not the reason. But if that's the reason, for sure, they're not going to go with Dennis Smith Jr. either. But still, like, a third, I would go with Dennis Smith Jr. if he was there, that he's probably going to be. But if the options are Jackson or Tatum, I would probably go Tatum. I would probably go Isaac above both guys. I don't know, like, I just don't see, like, I guess if you are signing Hayward and that's the idea, then Jackson's inability to shoot is less of a problem if you're putting him in a starting lineup with Bradley, Thomas, and Horford, because all of those guys are good shooters, and then you have Hayward as well. And then if you are putting your, like, best perimeter defender on Hayward, then Jackson might be able to beat down some force or some slower guys down the court, right? Like, that could be an option. And Hayward is a guy with a big enough frame to maybe, like, defend some force. We saw him doing a good job on Blake Griffin during the playoffs. Like, I think that could be an option. But, like, for that, you need to know that Hayward is there, or at least a guy similar to him is there, maybe via trade or something. Is Jimmy Butler the guy in that sense? Then maybe. Like, I just don't know if Jackson is going to bring enough upside to the third overall selection, unless you are really going all in a group based on Thomas, Horford, Hayward, and maybe another guy.
Yeah, I think just the indicator for me is that they're probably going to end up moving this pick, trading down to three, acquiring an additional asset. You know, it makes it more palatable maybe to make multiple deals via trades, acquire more assets. Jimmy Butler is the one that, you know, jumps off the table with the Bulls. Would they value a Josh Jackson as a replacement that highly? I do agree that Ainge seems to have a certain player type that he looks for. We saw some rumors last night that they weren't enamored with Markelle Fultz's kind of on-court gravitas as far as competitiveness and the record of the team. So if that's really how he's approaching this and he's going to take Josh Jackson here, I just think you can only get away so long with taking the same kind of player archetype. I mean, they're a little bit different, but we're talking about, like, two-way players who take a lot off the table shooting-wise. Like, we haven't seen Marcus Smart develop as a shooter. He has, like, hot streaks, but it hasn't really translated consistently. Jay Crowder's a great player, but you can only have so many of these types before you need...
Of the same.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Before you need that self-creator type, you need diversity in your lineups. You can't just build a team based on one archetype. It doesn't work that way. I get monopolizing, like, the wing market and stuff, but as we've gone back through the tape, I think you can mirror this as well. I think Jackson's creation acumen is a little bit overrated as far as his handle, as far as his shooting fluidity off the dribble. I think there are some issues there. I mean, he's a great transition player, but if they take him, I think that it's only going to compound their spacing issues and their versatility. So for me, it screams they're going to move this pick, or they're going to try to by acquiring an additional asset. And we'll see in time if, you know, Markelle Fultz comes back to bite him, because he could very well do so.
Yeah, like, I would say again, like, if this situation is where Jackson is playing at the four offensively, because you have a Hayward that can actually swing to the four defensively and like hold that position and all that, then I like the handle and the ability to create in space of Jackson much more, because you are forcing the defense basically to cover your less talented guy. In this case, it would be Jackson, of course, of both Jackson and Hayward, with a slower guy, just because you need the quicker and the better defender on Hayward. In those situations where he can be a true secondary and with enough spacing with Bradley, Thomas, and Horford, I think he could sign there. It's just like you need to know that you're going to acquire that other talented guy. Like, I guess they might have a trade in place, or they might have Hayward in free agency. You never know about that, which is going on with like secondary channels like on the backside and all that. But like, other than that, if you are planning on building up a nucleus that is going to be with Jackson and Jaylen Brown on the wings, I think that could be a bit dicey. Like, I don't really see that happening. But like, again, like, Ainge supposedly offered like 4 or 6 picks for Winslow at the time. So like, just like, it seems to be his type. I don't really understand. Like, I think to a degree, it makes sense to acquire valuable guys like that, but like when you are actually building towards something, you need to have only enough of those and not too many, because then the spacing becomes cramped, like you said. And like another point I would like to make, like the thing with the pick, like some people are saying like, okay, they're going to make a trade with Chicago, why did you trade the first straight up for Butler and all that? But like, the thing is, Chicago probably doesn't have enough offers out there that they need to trade the first one for Butler. That they might get away with trading number 3, because that might be the best offer on the table eventually. And then you can actually acquire another asset on the way. Like, you can get down to 3, have enough of an asset to trade for Butler or for whoever else is, like Paul George, the same case. Maybe the Indiana doesn't have enough offers out there. So like, is that the situation why? Like, if they actually are making that move, it's because they can. Like, I know it sounds like embarrassment of riches, but like, that's the situation. Like, Boston had the best assets for those guys. They still probably have the best assets for those guys, even after moving down to number 3.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I totally agree with that. There's no reason to, you know, stay at 1 if you're not going to take Fultz, when you can trade down to 3 and still have the best offer and gain an additional asset to where they can move multiple guys. Because that's kind of what I've been saying all along. If they're going to go all in on this current time frame in the LeBron age, in the Golden State age, they better get multiple of these guys. Like, maybe even like all 3 of George, yeah. Butler, and Hayward. I'm serious. Like, think about them competing and stuff. There's some talk, like, if they get Paul George, if they get Gordon Hayward, I don't think that's enough. Like, against LeBron, I just don't, and especially against the Warriors, you need all of these guys, and then it makes a lot of sense. If they literally go all in, and they have the pieces to maneuver around the board, they have enough, like,
juice. I think they can.
Yes, if they want to, they have enough juice to make multiple moves, and then, you know, create cap space to sign Hayward or something like that. So there's a lot of ways they can go, and it's going to be judged ultimately by if they're successful. I'm guessing they have some indications, at least, that these teams are going to entertain trades, or Gordon Hayward is definitely entertaining going to Boston. They have to have some kind of indication to move the number 1 pick. So if it's successful and Fultz doesn't turn out to be, you know, this mega star, which, I mean, that's one thing about this, is that Fultz isn't that Durant type, right? He's not that like high profile prospect. He's a good solid number 1 pick, but he's not a transcendent franchise player talent, in my opinion. So that's why you see the pick get moved. If this was Durant at number 1, I don't think this happens.
No, even if he was Towns, probably, right? Like, that's the thing. Like, we're talking about him more in the sense of like a Simmons level, John Wall level, maybe. Like, I mean, John Wall in retrospect, related to his draft class, probably won't have him move either. But like, another point there, I think it's important to consider the economics here. Like, I understand, like, probably more people don't really care about it, but like, I don't really think it's inconceivable that Wisbeck has seen that during the finals, the Warriors were making like, what, $11 million per game home? Like, even if you get only to the finals, maybe you get like $25 million if you are Boston, if you get 2 games home. Like, I'm not saying that that's all moot or anything, but like, I think it's something that could be important in this discussion. Like, they think they can build a good enough team to just beat Cleveland. Like, this is a business in the end. Like, if you're making money, it's better for the ownership, it's better for everybody. So if, like, I understand, like, in a competitive way or a team building way, I might not have gone this route, but if they are actually going all in, it kind of makes sense. And there are more reasons than just winning the title to go all in for a lot of ownership groups like that. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, I think you do a good job of pointing, like, putting context consistently as far as teams' goals differ. Every team's goal is not to win the title. It's also economics. It's to make the playoffs. It's to gain fanship. So there are different driving forces. Let's go down the top of the draft order here and see your thoughts on any kind of trickle-down effect. Let's say that Tatum goes 3 to Boston. I think that there's a decent chance of that. That seems to be the building momentum here. I think Draft Express has Tatum going 3 now. I'm going to double-check that while we do this.
I remember that, yeah.
So what do you think about, like, where does Josh Jackson go now? I mean, we've seen a lot of reports that he had a promise in the top of the draft. Do you buy that? And where, how far do you see him falling? Do you think he falls past the Suns at four?
I mean, my thinking before this was that all these smoke screens about the promise and all that was more related to him, like, losing momentum and maybe wanting to, like, pull anything out or pump his stock with those type of talks. Like, you know that the front office have no problem helping somebody with, like, some talk behind the doors just because that way they can get, like, the benefit of the doubt with the agent down the road for other players and stuff like that. I thought it was more like that and he was falling. That was my... like my instincts there, my gut feeling. But maybe actually he has that type of promise with Boston now. I don't know if Tatum might be the choice, but, like, it seems like they are still trying to get Josh Jackson for a workout in Boston. So if they get him to go there during the next few days, I will consider, like, either Jackson or Tatum are the guys there. If it's Jackson that falls and it's Tatum the one that is picked, I will guess, like, either Phoenix, or if he doesn't get picked by Phoenix, I won't be surprised if he slides all the way to either Minnesota or New York. Like, I think both... me and you and also Mark have, like, sour on him, and sour or not, that actually you won't think it's all inconceivable if he falls in the 5-7 range, right? Like, that makes more sense to me. I think the best fit for him in the draft could be New York, actually. I know it seems a bit weird right now, and he probably won't fall all that far, but, like, I don't like him in Minnesota either with Wiggins. I think Phoenix is probably the best one that is realistic. It's just, like, I don't even know if they're choosing him above Isaac, right? Like, that could be another selection for the Suns. It seems like two of those guys are going third and fourth, and the other one that is left free might slide all the way to, like, 6 or 7 or something like that.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the Suns, that's going to be a pretty serious consideration. I know they've shown some legitimate interest in Isaac, and that would make some sense as well. I really don't have a good read on Phoenix right now. I think they could go so many different ways. Yeah. We hear that they want to trade up for Ball to the Lakers. If they get enamored with Josh, I could see them trading back to four, potentially, and leaving Ball on the table. I don't think it's likely. I think that the likely course of action is going to be Ball at two, and that would get really interesting for Boston at three, either via Ball going to Boston or in a trade. I don't know if he has more trade demand than Josh does or whatnot, but I can definitely echo what you're saying. I could see Josh, you know, falling to potentially number eight just because of the lack of shooting. I think teams maybe have gone back over his film and think now that he might not be the player that the idea of him is, essentially, as, like, this two-way scoring type. I mean, you see, we've noted this several times, but, like, the McGrady comparisons as a ceiling outcome, teams are probably looking at it now being like, nah, that's not even in the realm of outcomes. So I could see him falling just because of the lack of shooting. We see these last second adjustments, maybe the character concerns, you know, overwhelm some teams, who knows. But yeah, I think that this mock is so hard to predict outside of maybe Fox at five to the Kings. I think that looks like the most, like, surefire bet if he's still on the board. But outside of that, like, four and six, especially, like, the Magic could go so many different ways. We talked about this on the last podcast. Do you have any, like, leans about who goes 4-6 right now?
I mean, my thinking is, like, either Isaac or Jackson go fourth, and then the Sacramento gets Fox, and then if Dennis is there at six, I think he's the pick. Like, just because of that report that he canceled a workout with New York after having a workout in Orlando, and then that's all the rumors starting over there. I think it could be a good option for the Magic as well, especially the front office is not married to, like, drafting around, like, Elfrid Payton and all that, because he's a guy that they didn't pick in the first place because they are all new. So, like, if that's the case, I think Smith makes sense for them. Maybe they won't go that way. I think it depends. Maybe they have Isaac ahead of him, so if Isaac is there, they beat him, but if it's Jackson, they go with Smith. So, like, that would be one of my gut feelings there. And then, like, it gets too dicey. Like, it's really difficult for me. Like, Phoenix and Orlando, like you said, like, those are really puzzling for me. Like, it's difficult to just pencil a guy in, because the best player available for me is going to be Dennis Smith Jr. at all those stages. I don't think he makes much sense for either Phoenix or Sacramento, just because, like, not because I don't think he's better of a prospect than Devin Booker, but, like, Phoenix is probably going to build still around Booker in a way. Even if I don't agree with that sentiment, like, it's probably going to be the case. So that means that if you're projecting Smith there, it's not only about, like, is he going to be the best player available in a vacuum? Is he going to be the best player available if he's groomed in that system and groomed in that circumstances? So I will guess that for Phoenix, best player available is probably more of a frontcourt guy like Isaac or Tatum or Josh, probably more like Josh or Isaac. And then for Sacramento or for Orlando, I think point guards should be in play. I understand that some people will not like probably Dennis to go to Sacramento just because he's such a dumpster of fire. But like still, I think it's a team that could actually make some sense for him just because they actually have some shooters in the frontcourt now with Scal. They have the situation where they can just surround him with Buddy Hill and some other standstill shooters over there and just play pick and roll with like Willie and like the stuff like that and just have that team be his. So I mean, it seems that they are pretty enamored with Fox, so I guess if they go point guard, they will go with him ahead of Dennis. And then for Orlando again, like I think it makes sense for them to pick a guy like Dennis Smith Jr. Like if you are looking for that type of star equity and primary equity, like you are not going to find a better option there at six overall. So that would be my feeling. Like he's probably the best player available for all those teams. And then they're probably not going to pick him unless Isaac is not there for Orlando. I think if Isaac is there, he gets pick six, and if he's not, it's probably Dennis there. So that's my only projection, I would guess.
I think that's definitely fair. You have the John Hammond effect replacing Rob Hennigan in Orlando. He kind of has that draft philosophy of more upside-y length that fits Isaac's profile a bit better than Dennis Smith. I agree. That's what
also
I said.
Also, Wellman from Toronto.
Yes. Yeah. So that was my exact read on the situation. I said that I'd be surprised if it wasn't Isaac or Smith at that spot. I think it's going to be either De'Aaron Fox or Tatum at five to the Kings, depending on who's there, but likely Fox. Yeah. And then Phoenix, I really don't have a good feel on at all. I just think they could go so many different ways. We'll see if they trade up. But let's get into the 7 and 9 picks, because this is something that Mark and I already recorded, and then unfortunately it got tarnished, so we got to do this again.
No problem.
The Wolves are actually the most interesting team around here for me, just because they have a franchise building block outside of course, Philadelphia, who has two potentially, but the Wolves have Towns, so they can start to look to build around him. We have Wiggins and Levine, Chris Dunn last year, potentially a Ricky Rubio trade or whatnot. Is there anybody here that sticks out to you? How do you view their young core outside of Towns? Does the presence of Andrew Wiggins or Levine negate you from taking, for say, like a Malik Monk here, if you think he's the best player available? Is there any specific fit that you like? Especially Isaac, probably.
I like Nilikina even more than Isaac here. I know might not make much sense for some people, but like the problem with me here is like you have to more or less consider what you have and what you have in place. Like it seems like Thibs, like Dieng, and the front office is built around Thibs right now, and I don't think the owner is going to lose faith anytime soon on him, at least for the next 3 or 4 years, I will guess. And then in that situation, if Dieng is going to play, even if he's going to be like a 25-30 minutes player, like I don't really know if you are building the team around Towns. Do you need another guy that is going to play like the forward spot for that long? Are next to him, is Thibs going to play with only one big? Is that going to happen at all? Like, that's my thinking against Isaac and why I don't see it happening. Like, if it was like a perfect scenario, like for sure, Isaac makes a lot of sense, but you need to have the front office committed to that. And if they are not, the best 3MD guy is what they need, and the best 3MD prospect at this stage, I will guess the best 3MD prospect in the whole top 10 actually is probably Nilikina, just because like the other guys are either 3 and not D or D and not 3. And then the situation is like he has basically both at a young age. He makes sense to play even like next to a point guard, even if he gets a bit bigger, maybe next to two guards if the guards are big enough. He's like versatile enough that he can bring the like come from the bench probably. It's like you are punting a little bit on Chris Dunn just because like he was supposed to be the defensive version of that from the point guard position, but he can shoot. And he loses the ball all the time. And like that's the situation where like, you have to like just come to grips. And if you just blow a pick, you blow a pick, and that's fine. And I think they can be compatible as well. Like I don't think one negates another all that much. I like Tyus Jones a lot, but like it's not that I'm going to draft with him in mind. The same with Rubio. Like I like Rubio, but like I'm not going to draft with him in mind. So if I'm thinking about a team with Kat and just maybe Wiggins, I will not consider many more guys than that to make this pick. I think Nilikina makes sense. Probably it's not going to be him. I won't be surprised if it's Markkanen, just because it seems like Thibs is trying to adapt to the modern basketball, but in a way that is not completely all the way there, just a little bit. And Markkanen in that sense makes sense because he's a big that can stretch the floor. Probably for Thibs that sounds like pretty modern, but it's not all that modern because he can really switch or defend multiple positions. So he's like a half-ass solution, maybe. That's the best explanation for me there. So those would be the guys that I think would be in consideration. But like the guy I like the most is Frenchie Frankie.
Interesting. I've not heard that take yet there. I think that for some of the realistic purposes you're pointing out, maybe they view him as too duplicative with Dunn, even though he does bring more shooting, of course. But defensively, they kind of fill that same role. Do you see Neal Aquina down the road as the point guard or Dunn or whatnot? I think that they're going to build in mind with those core three guys of Towns, of course, Wiggins and LaVine. So do they complement those guys with legit defenders? Because they have Rubio at the one, who's a legit defender. At the four, if they go Lowry from an ideal setting, I mean, their offense might be, like, unguardable as far as from a spacing perspective. I mean, you put Towns, who's, like, the best self-creating center in the league, like, fluidity-wise, if you put him in pick and roll and you have a legit space floor, he's going to kill everyone. Wiggins can score. LaVine can score. His shooting has been way higher than expected, at least for me personally. I did not expect him to shoot that well from a young age. So it's really an interesting kind of fork in the road here. Like, Tibbs could go marketing it, and they could just spread everybody out. They could score at a high level, but their defense is going to continue to be awful. Or they can go with Isaac, who probably isn't going to be here anymore. I think I'd be surprised if he fell to seven, but that's clearly the fit for me. I mean, he complements so many of these on-ball scorers so well with his defensive versatility. He's a willing passer. He'll move the ball and make the extra pass. He's a great fit next to Towns. Would actually allow Towns to shift back and guard fives.
Yeah, but that makes a lot of sense in your mind, but, like, the thing is, what if Thibs actually plays him at the three with Wiggins at the two and with Rubio at the one, and then he plays with DN and Towns at the big positions? Like, that could be a thing that happens if they actually draft Isaac. Like, that's why I'm not all the way in there. And not only that, like, they have $64 million invested in DN. Like, he's not going to be a contract that you're going to be able to move easily. Like, I know he's a quality player. You might be able to dump him just for free if that's the case, because you want to make that move. But, like, Minnesota core is going to get pretty pricey not that late from now. And, like, it's just, I would like to allocate resources in the right way with the right philosophy of your front office. Like, if you think Thibs is not going to use that guy at his best spot, and he's going to play him at the four, or he's going to play two bigs, I will not go Isaac. But if he's going to play him right, maybe I will go Isaac because of the fit being that great. But, like you said, he might not be there. So if he's not there, who do you think they pick? Like, if let's say that Tatum goes third, Jackson goes fourth, Fox goes fifth, and Isaac goes sixth. Like, which is the guy that you're going to pick there of the rest of the pool available? Is it Monk? Is it Neal Aquina? Is it Dennis Smith Jr. after picking Dan last year and having Tyus and Rubio there?
I would still pick
Dennis
Smith.
That's my question there.
Me personally, I would pick Dennis Smith because I don't think they have that primary initiator equity, and they have enough surrounding talent to where I think that they could, you know, double down on some other creation. And Smith, to me, is the most high upside pick at that spot. I don't think it's
that
I don't think it's that realistic. I mean, they took Dunn last year. Who knows if they still view him as a point guard? I think if Isaac's off the board, and even Monk's still there,
I think they take
Markkanen. I was just gonna say, I think they go Lowry here. Just a fit, you can slide him into the four. It's just, I don't agree with that. I think that Towns is really the only guy they should be building around. Wiggins hasn't shown enough, and I know that's not realistic. These guys, the league is obviously higher on Wiggins than we are, and same with LaVine, but I just don't think that's a winning basketball recipe to have both LaVine and Wiggins as perimeter defenders and score first guys who don't really play make for others. I just don't like the recipe that they're generating right now. So in an ideal sense, if Isaac's there, he complements all that core well enough to where maybe they could be something. But at the end of the day, I'm really just looking at Towns as the fixture point here and trying to build around him.
Yeah, so if they're not considering Smith Jr. just because of Dan, then after that, you're pretty much making the case for me for Neal Aquina, kind of, right? Because Monk and LaVine are actually two guys that probably won't be able to defend either, especially if you add Wiggins to the math. And Markkanen, you say it yourself. So if Dennis Smith is not going to be considered and Isaac is not on paper just because he's being picked ahead, like, you know, don't you think Neal Aquina makes some sense in that situation, actually?
I do. I think that the points you're making resonate with me, but I just don't find it realistic. Like, they're going to go that way.
No, for sure,
I think that, like you said, it's going to be Isaac or Markkanen, barring, I think even if Tatum were to fall, I don't know if they'd take him. I mean, he's not a great fit in that roster as far as being another self-creator ball kind. I don't think he has to be a ball solver, but I mean, he's not like the most willing ball mover. When you pair him with Wiggins, they have a lot of overlapping skills, even if Tatum's the better prospect. I think Mark argued for taking Tatum here. I can't remember specifically in our recording. But I don't see that as realistic, and I wouldn't do that necessarily. But I think that Tatum's a better prospect than Ntilikina, and I'm kind of in the middle of you and Mark as far as assessing Frank. I like him, but I'm not sure if I'm all in on him yet. So from a pure talent perspective, I could see that Tatum fit, even though he doesn't fit on the roster, just as far as taking best player available. But I definitely get your argument for Ntilikina here.
I mean, I understand Tatum. Like, I won't be mad at Tatum. I think he fits better than Jos, at least. Like, I think Tatum makes more sense because at least I think he's more, like, projectable to be a shooter at some degree than Jos is. So in that sense, he fits better with Wiggins for sure, even if they like to operate in the mid-range a little bit, both of them and all that. And I think he might be able to defend some fours better than Jos also, like, with in terms of strength. So I think Tatum makes more sense than Jos, at least. Of course, Isaac makes more sense than both if you are going that route. And if you're going the route of the real wing or the 3MD prospect, I think, like I said, Ntilikina makes the most sense. Like, for me, drafting Lowry will, like, settle in a little bit for a low floor. And I don't think they need to do that. Like, they have enough guys that the low floor makes no sense. Just go for it. Go for the guy that might bring the most upset of the ones available. Like, if you are going to settle for a shooter, you sign a guy in free agency. They have enough cap space to sign a shooter in the front court as well.
I totally agree. So, gun to your head right now, who do you think they go with, given reality of the circumstances? Who do you think, if Lowry's on the board, let's say that Isaac's off the board, do you think they go Lowry?
I think they go Lowry, yeah. I think if I'm going to make a prediction, I'm going to go Lowry, just because unless Phoenix takes Isaac, I think Isaac is going to, I mean, unless Phoenix takes, in both cases, like if Phoenix takes Isaac, he's not going to be available. And if not, I think he's going to go to Orlando. And I don't think they're going to consider Dennis. Yeah. So I think he's going to be Markkanen. Yeah, I'm pretty prepared for that, at least in my mind.
Okay, let's move on to New York at 8, because I think this is kind of a fascinating discussion. I think there's going to be a really good player here available. Yeah. So I think New York's going to be saved from themselves a little bit. We know the triangle impact with Phil. Ntilikina is potentially a great triangle point guard. I think that's kind of his optimal offensive usage if he's not a two guard. I think he's more of a two guard than a one. I don't think he's a straight, like, 1-5 pick and roll kind of point guard. We have Kristaps as the building block there as far as a unicorn archetype to build around. Where do you see them leaning right now? Where would you go right here as a fit around Kristaps? Where are you leaning?
I mean, it depends on what is available. If we're projecting like we are, like, none of the forwards are left, and maybe Lowry is the pick for Minnesota, I guess it's all guard, because it's just the best guys that are going to be there, unless you are actually considering Zach Collins or anything like that. And then it would be something between Monk, Ntilikina, and Smith, right? The debate is there for those three guys. That seems to be the case, that any of them can be available at 8th. I think if you are looking at pure triangle position, of course, Ntilikina makes the most sense. If you're looking at a mix back between triangle and being able to do some of the other world that is outside of the triangle as well, Monk could be the guy that can actually bring some level of upside on both ends. And if you're looking for a pure pick and roll guy that can actually create pick and pop situation for Porzingis and actually have the higher upside, is probably Dennis Smith Jr. It's just like another situation like I was talking about Phoenix. Like, Dennis Smith Jr. is the guy probably with the higher upside here. But is he going to be the best player available for a team that is not going to develop him in the right way? And is he going to be that guy for a team that is going to try to play the triangle? I will lean not. So it all depends on how long you think that system with Phil is going to be in place and how much they are going to try to embrace it. Because if they are going to go that route all along for like 5 years, you might just lost completely your value if you pick Dennis Smith Jr. here. So I will argue for either Monk or Ntilikina, if that's the case. Like, in terms of overall value, probably Smith. But I will guess, like, from all the, like, all everything we read, like, of course, we are being manipulated from behind and there is a lot of smoke screens and all that. Everything we read means to me that probably they are leaning towards Ntilikina here, but you never know. I think it's going to be between him and Monk. That's my mindset.
Yeah, I think that has a lot of merit to it. This is a fascinating position, like I said, because, I mean, there's going to be a good player here, and you can make arguments for a lot. I would take Dennis Smith here pretty easily just based on talent. I'm not considering the triangle conceptually as far as me in a vacuum long term. I think Dennis Smith would be an awesome pick and roll pairing with Kristaps. I mean, the gravity that Kristaps commands on pick and pops would just open the lane up for Dennis. And hypothetically, I think that could be an awesome fulcrum of an offense. So that has a lot of allure for me. Ntilikina, of course, you have the short term fit as well as the long term kind of ability to slide over to the two in a more like spread pick and roll system if that's how they go down the road. And then, of course, you have Monk, who, again, I think is a great fit here as far as short-term and long-term. He can play triangle point guard. He showed at least enough of a handle to bring the ball across half court. I don't think he's going to be a full-time guy there. But in the triangle, he can handle New York as far as the climate there and, like, you know, he's a star kind of personality, a star, you know, performer. He's a huge scorer. So I really like his fit next to Kristaps too. And if you think that he has any kind of initiator equity, I'm a little suspect on that. But I think that it's not completely crazy to assume that he develops enough of a handle that he becomes some kind of a lead guard, scheme-changing threat. So that option is there. But my overarching takeaway from the Knicks spot is basically that they're going to get a good player here. There's too many guys that fit well at the number eight spot. I think that I have a top seven in my draft board. You probably have a top eight with Ntilikina. And that doesn't include both Fox and Markkanen, who are both decent bets to go ahead, especially if Isaac goes to Orlando at six. So they're going to be looking at a pretty good player here.
Yeah, that's my thinking, basically. Like, I think they can really lose. Like I said, like, Monk is a bit in between Ntilikina and Smith in terms of fit. Like, he can bring the best of all worlds, theoretically, if everything goes right, or the worst, you never know. But, like, at least, like, they are going to be able to pick between two of those guys, I think. Like, that's basically the situation. Even if it's only Fox that goes ahead of them, I think they are going to be able to pick between two of them. So that's something to be said for being lucky at this stage, because most of the drafts, they don't have that type of guy at the number eight overall, I would say.
Agreed.
So that's part of the allure of this class. Like, the top 10 is that deep, at least on paper. Maybe the high upside is not there for every of these guys, but at least you can have the argument of like a big enough tier two or tier three, depending on how much you want to divide that secondary level between guys. And yeah, I have like a top eight, and after that it comes like Mark Collins and Mitchell, basically. So yeah, we are probably at the same level already than Ntilikina, that I have him a bit ahead of you. Maybe that's the situation. But then if we are talking about Dallas, they're probably going to try to outguard as well. I would guess that is probably an easy decision for them, just because one of those guys are going to be left, and they might be their pick, basically. Like, if New York goes Ntilikina, they might be able to decide between Smith and Monk, and if another team ahead of them goes with one of those guys instead of Lowry, they might not even have to make that call. They just have to pick the one that is left. It would be only one guy left. So it could be an easy decision. I think Smith Jr. is the easiest pick for them, just because it makes a lot of sense to have a primary in that roster. They don't really have that type of guy. I know Barnes has been like a nice scorer this year, but you can really go forward with that type of scheme and try to be successful, especially down the road. And especially for the first years in the league of Smith, if Dirk is going to play two more years in those lineups that they play Dirk at the five, that can help a ton his pick and roll, pick and pop game, and even pick and roll with Nerlens Noel, right? Like, we expect him to resign. So, like, if that's the situation, I think it's a good environment for him, other than Carlisle being a bit tough on some rookies, especially on some point guards. And defensively and in terms of things like that, it might be rough at first, but if he adapts and if he competes, he's going to get playing time, because guys like Yogi Ferrell got playing time last year. Seth Curry got playing time right away, and he was basically a favorite of Carlisle. Even Devin Harris and guys like that. Like, he's always playing multiple guards. So I think for Dallas, it makes sense to go that route and just get a bit more of a younger legs in the backcourt, because they don't really have an option there. Even if you believe in Seth Curry and Yogi Ferrell, they are more likely like backups if the team is ever going to be like a, not even contender, but maybe a pretender.
Yeah, I think that you hit the nail on the head on basically all of that. The depth in this lottery, as far as being able to get, in my opinion, like the second or the third best talent at number nine at Dennis Smith, that just rarely happens. You don't get a chance to draft those athletic guards who are skilled at the ninth overall pick. It just rarely, they rarely fall that far. I mean, we see, like, Eric Bledsoe would be kind of the outlier scenario just with his fit in Kentucky. He obviously fell a lot further in the draft, but it just rarely happens this way. I think this is Dennis Smith's floor. If he's there, I don't know how they pass on him. As far as they need lead guard creation, this is a perfect spread pick and roll system that can, you know, magnify his strengths. He's not the greatest pick and roll.
I think there is one scenario. If New York goes Ntilikina, if New York goes Monk, and it's between Ntilikina and Smith in this pick, I think Dallas could lean Ntilikina ahead of him, and then he falls another level. I won't be all that surprised. It's just like, you will have to get New York drafting Monk ahead of those two guys, and I don't know if that's all that I like.
Yeah, I can see that. I just would not make that call. I mean, if it's between Dennis Smith and Ntilikina, I don't see the comparison as far as in Dallas's scheme specifically, when they need, like, they run more spread pick and roll. Like, that's kind of their bread and butter. They are the pick and roll machine. And I don't get the argument for Ntilikina over Smith in that setting. I think that Smith just profiles way better as an on-ball primary initiator than Ntilikina does. I know that Cuban's flown to Europe to meet with Ntilikina and, you know, has some personal contact. I think that's probably just doing due diligence. I think he's a real threat I think he's a real threat to go there, Neil Akina, if Smith isn't on the board. I just don't get conceptually how they would make that call when you have Nerlens as like a pick and roll dynamo. You have Dirk's gravity. You have Barnes capable of playing the four. I think this is like literally the perfect fit for Smith as far as if he fell this far, that'd be a good outcome for him, even though he sacrifices some finances, obviously. But as far as putting him in the best role to succeed, we've seen that. Like you talked about that with New York. That's not the best short-term role for him to succeed, but he plugs right into Dallas's system, and I think he can be an impact player.
I think he's the best fit for him if he can get past Carlisle at first. Like if he can get past that, like that tough coaching and all that, like that could be the best fit for him as well. Just because like the next one could be Orlando, just because they probably will hand him the keys and that's the situation. But like other than that, like the situation in Orlando with the spacing and the two bigs and how they are going to solve the whole situation they have economically and go down the road with a upside project and all that, I think Dallas has a better outcome to be like a competitive team. So only because of that, I think that makes sense. But it's either for me Dallas or Orlando in terms of fitting the top 10. And like you said, like it's unlikely that Smith falls past this spot other than if Dallas has to have the chance to pick between him and French Frank, basically. Like that's the only situation I could see that they would lean towards Frank, just because they have done that before a little bit. Like they have gone those routes with this management group, with Cuban especially and Donnie Nelson, like in the past, like guys like Devin Harris got picked by Dallas when they traded the Jerick Stackhouse to get that pick in before from Washington and all that with that selection. So I think it might make some sense. They traded actually Antoine Jamison, for Jerick Stackhouse on the pick. I think they like those type of players. It's just, for me, the upside is higher with Smith. I think I have him a tier above. I need to make the call in terms of dividing the tiers a bit more. So I will not like select him ahead of Frank ahead of him. But other than that, I think the situation becomes even more interesting for the next guys available, right? Because we'll talk about Dallas at ninth. We're not going to go now in depth with the 10th guy, but like, what if actually Lowry and Fox go ahead? Like that might mean that either Monk is available at 10 for Sacramento to be able to reconfigure the backcourt at Kentucky with Fox and Monk if they want to go that route and they don't consider Buddy Hill the next budding star in that slot. Or they could go with Zach Collins there, or even with Donovan Mitchell if they consider another more defensive guy next to Fox. They have plenty of options for that 10th pick if actually Lowry goes also in the top 7.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one more note on Neil Akina. Let's actually go in depth on Kings at 10. We're doing really well on time, so let's go into that. But really quick, on Neil Akina, Dallas's international scouting department is really advanced. So if they take Neil Akina over Smith, that's a vote of confidence in Smith and Neil Akina's upside as far as projecting to the NBA level, because those guys, I've met a couple of their international scouts, and they have one of the most advanced groups, I think, in the league. So if they do select Neil Akina, I'm going to be much higher on his upside than maybe like New York selecting him. I don't know. I just think it's a better fit.
If our guess is that Neil Akina and Smith go 8th and 9th in some combination, then it would be Monk, the one that slides to 10th. What would you do if you were Sacramento between him and maybe Collins or Mitchell? I guess that's the conundrum here. Those are the three guys that you might want to select. Like, on one hand, they have a lot of bigs, but on the other, I don't really like any of those bigs as starters, potentially, or like I'm not all the way there in that sense. So I won't be totally opposed selecting Collins. And then is the thing like how much you believe on their bigs versus how much you believe in Buddy Hill, I guess, or how much you believe in Collins versus you believe in Monk, right? Like, it's both sides of the equation there.
I would take Monk without batting an eyelash. I think he's a better prospect than all those guys. I have Monk 5th on my board. I'm really high in his shot making. I'm not as high on Hield, of course. I mean, we've talked about this in the past. I think he can be like a rotation shooter. I think he's fine. I'm not marrying any kind of decision making in the future to him as far as his position on the roster. I understand the actual reality of the circumstance that they traded to Marcus Cousins and Hield was a major part in that deal. I totally understand that. But even if you talk about that from a value perspective, like Monk at 10 is a great value in my opinion. Like he's the last guy on the board that I think can have like an impact contribution skill wise, as far as he's elite probably at one skill, right? His established shooting in a diverse amount of ways, you just don't really get that at 10 either, as far as that intersection with athleticism, depending on what you think the self-creation upside is with the ball. But like I wouldn't understand taking Zach Collins over him, who I think has much he doesn't have nearly the amount of upside And the fit even there is a little tenuous. If you play Scal at the four, Willie Cauley-Stein at the five, you take a reserve kind of five there. I like Zach Collins a lot, and he's the only big in this class that I think has like legitimate starter equity. But I don't see him becoming an impact NBA center in multiple capacities with the lack of elite length to contest on the perimeter. He's more of a finisher only. We've talked about this as far as not being much of a playmaker. So I would go Monk. If that's the situation and Monk falls to 10, I think that's a no-brainer pick regardless of Buddy Hield.
Yeah, that's not a bad argument for it. Like, the only thing I would say is, like, I like Collins better than both LaVisier and Cauley-Stein, and better than I like it both before the draft classes. I think I had LaVisier in the late first, and I definitely had Scal. No, sorry, I had definitely had Willie Cauley-Stein in, like, after the lottery. I had him, like, 16th or 17th. I didn't like him all that much. So, like, it's just overall, like, I will not marry myself to any of the bigs. I will not marry myself to Buddy Hield either. So it's just the biggest upside here, right? Like, if that's the way and you think Monk is ahead of Collins, you should go that route. I think Collins has some upside that is unexplored. It's just because, like, he can be a real small ball center during the playoffs without surrounding all that much size. Yep. Using the very same sense that you can actually play Isaac there, but actually Collins might be a better option in that situation because he might be able to actually bring some potential in terms of being able to posterize some guys and being able to get advantage against wingy guys if they are playing the center. So I think that's really interesting. I can see him playing a big role for a team if they go that far. But like for Sacramento at that point, maybe you just want to get the best talent just because they are so devoid of talent overall. They are not willing to just think about like which guy can be useful in a really specific situation in the playoffs. Like let's better go there first or better get like the guy that can actually make sense as a scoring prospect just because we don't have enough of that right now.
Yeah, I think they have to go best player available. They don't have any kind of franchise caliber talent on their roster. I like Cauley-Stein a little bit. I've soured on him a lot as far as his defensive upside. I just don't think it's there mentally. He's kind of a space cadet. But like Draft Express right now has Ntilikina falling all the way to 14 to the Heat. And I would absolutely, if Ntilikina was on the board at 10, I would absolutely consider him there, even ahead of even Zach Collins. As far as I know that they had Buddy Hield, I know that they would probably take De'Aaron Fox in this setting, but you can downsize. You can downsize because Ntilikina has that 7'1 wingspan, 6'6. I mean, there's going to be a lot of lineups where you can play those guys together with Ntilikina shooting. So I think that that is an option that can be explored. And I think his upside is a little higher than Collins's as far as just being a wing that's in more positionally in demand, a two-way player. So that's something that hasn't gotten a lot of publicity. I think a lot of people are thinking about bigs going to 10. Like if Lauri Markkanen falls past Minnesota at 7, I think that he's in very much in play here. I don't think it's his floor. I think he could fall a little bit further, but I would seriously think that he would be in play. What do you think about Lowry at 10?
I think Lowry's floor is more like Chicago at 16th. I don't think he goes past that point, or even Miami at 14th. I think that's his absolute floor. If we're talking about absolute floor, I think he's more like Miami probably at 14th. But like if we're talking about Lowry at 10th, like it makes sense a little bit at least in the sense like if you are picking Fox at 5th overall, at least you are giving Fox a tool to work with. Like if at least you are giving him something to succeed. Like at least you are going to go that route all in on Fox. We're picking him 5th. We're going to marry our future to him in some sense. Sure, like if you are doing it in that capacity, maybe you can justify Lowry's pick there just because he can actually pick and pop and work great with him, and you can actually play him even next to Scal in some lineups and get a lot of spacing just because Scal might be able to protect the rim a little bit as a weak side rim protector. He's not going to just be able to stop guys at the rim because he's not strong enough, but like coming from the side, he might be able to make something going then. So like the thing I would say about Ntilikina, like I would be surprised, no, like crazy astonished if he doesn't get picked by Denver if he's there. Like I don't see him going past the Nuggets. Like I understand that it might not make all that sense with Gary Harris and Jamal Murray. But like still, like you said with the Kings, like they might be able to play all those three guys together at times just because you can play the stronger guy like Harris in the wing that doesn't do anything of the dribble and he just needs to be strong enough to be able to just avoid him from bullying him. So in that situation, I think you can survive from some lineups with that, and you need rotation guards eventually. So I would be completely shocked if he gets past Denver. I would consider that his floor, but like they have him at 14th and they probably know enough. I think some people have soured on Ntilikina in terms of mocking him higher just because he's playing on the French finals and he hasn't been able to do any workouts for anybody or anything like that. And unless the French finals gets like solved quicker than we think, like they are still in game 3, I think they probably need to go through more games or even maybe only one more, but still that means that he's going to be available like after 2 days from now. And the draft is in like 4 days. So like they're not going to be able to get much information, and that might be a reason why he might be sliding a little bit in the mocks.
That makes sense. And I think, like, maybe guys are coming around to the fact he's not a surefire point guard bet. I still think that he has a ton of value in this class. I brought up the Lowry point to the Kings for the exact point that you made as far as being a nice pick-and-pop pairing with De'Aaron Fox. Like, potentially, we'll see how that works out. You ideally want to pair Fox with a pick-and-pop guy to open up the lane for him. And I don't think Scal has that kind of gravity as a pick-and-roll player. So if you're going to surround De'Aaron Fox and you think that he is one of the building blocks, I think that Lowry makes some sense there. I would not pick him there just because I'm lower on him, of course. I have him like the 14-15 range, but I could totally understand that. They're going to be facing an interesting dilemma as far as perhaps multiple guys on the board there. Donovan Mitchell is a little less upsidey in my opinion. He does have that two-way potential, and I do like him on a winning team. I think he's more of that Norman Powell type. And we can talk about Charlotte really quick. I don't think it's that complicated as far as to go over their options and what they should do. I think they just need to pick the highest upside guy on the board. They just have no flexibility cap room wise. They're not going to be able to add talent to their roster, and they're kind of capped out to what they can do as far as they have Kemba Walker. They have Nicholas Batum, who had a down year last year. MKG is kind of regressed shooting wise after Mark Price left. And really, what do they really have on their roster? So, I mean, I've seen some Luke Kennard or Justin Jackson mocked at 11. I don't get that. Like, if Neal Akeen is here, I think they have to pull the trigger on him.
Yeah, like, for me, the math is really simple. Like, I have a top 10 really defined, like, top 10 guys, and I'm pretty sure De'Aaron Fox is going to go there, and he's not in my top 10. So whoever is there at 11, just take that guy. Like, it could be Donovan Mitchell, it could be Neal Akeen, it could be Monk, it could be Collins. Like, I don't mind Collins, even if you have Seller. Like, they have Miles Plumlee. I don't know if he's going to be able to play anything for them or play a role for them. They have Kaminsky, that is more of a five if you want to bring the equity that he can create as a shooter, even if he's able to shoot enough, because he hasn't been all that effective. But, like, still, like, none of those guys are going to stop me from taking Collins, and maybe Seller is your most valuable guy if you are going to pull a trade down the road or anything like that. Like, I won't marry myself to any of those guys that they have in the roster, maybe to Kemba. And I actually would probably be more towards the position of trading Kemba while you can. He has two more years in that really cheap contract. You can acquire the most value this summer by far. I would just go that route and rebuild a little bit more. Probably they're going to go in that direction. But I think even Collins is most likely to go get pick at 10th or something like that and fall to 11th. But even like between Collins and Mitchell, just if that's the most likely guy to be there, probably go that route and definitely go that route before you pick Kennard or Justin Jackson. Like, the only other guy that I might consider if you are not going to go with Zach Collins just because of the conundrum they have of white guys in the middle, I would probably consider if Mitchell is not there available, none of the other top 10 guys other than Collins is, I would go either with Fran Jackson or Derrick White. I know most mocks have him much lower, but I like both guys enough to be combination guards and being better players than Kennard. I like the abilities of both those guys in terms of being able to do a bit more athletically and a bit more in terms of being able to have more upside defensively as well. I know Jackson, we burned him a little bit during the year for his defense actions and all that, and he is not much of a creator, but I do like him, and I like his shooting ability. I think he's kind of historically good for a freshman as a guard in terms of shooting. I know that might not be everything you want for an 11 pick, but I think it makes some sense. Probably he's not going to be a possibility there. But I definitely will go with any of those guys, and especially Mitchell ahead of Kennard and Justin Jackson.
Yeah, so you've soured on OG Anunoby a little bit, haven't you? Because he's not.
But it makes no much sense in this context, right? Like,
that's
he's
fair.
Just. Yeah, it's just.
That was going to be my question. Is it situational? Obviously, in the Hornets, he's not a good fit next to MKG, of course, because you can't survive lack of two shooters like that. I was just curious if it's in general or you just in the specific context here, because I have OG in my top 10 for sure. I know that, you know, the reports coming out on him have not been stellar as far as, you know, he's dropped to 21 now in Draft Express. You can see probably the medical concerns. Where do you stand on him now?
I have him in the top 15. I think...
Okay.
It makes a lot of sense if he goes 13th for them in Denver situation for me. Like, that would be where I can predict and project him to be a really good player that is valuable of that selection or even a higher selection, which makes a lot of sense if you are picking him there because you're actually bringing some extra upside. Other than that, I would be quite hesitant of having him ahead of my top 10 guys. I think I have a quite defined top 10, and the other two guys that I like the most are White and Fran Jackson, probably. OJ is the next guy. But just because of the Denver fit being so good, I would like him a little bit also for Portland, especially if they are willing to move Aminu eventually, or if they are not all married to any of the bigs, because they can play some big line, small liners with him at even center eventually, and they have done that with Aminu, so they probably can pull it out with OJ as well. It's just other than that, I don't really like Miami, for example. They have a lot of non-shooters already with Winslow and some other guys. Yeah. If they can bring back James Johnson, like stuff like that, Whiteside playing the center, I don't see it going all that well there. And Charlotte, like I said, I'm not married to that roster, but like probably they are in some sense. So I just don't see a venue for him to develop. Like, you have to consider the first year of a first round pick as something that have to bring any sort of value, because if for whatever reason, either he's not a good fit in your system or he's just a really raw guy that is not going to bring much. At the end of that, you're going to have to make a decision in terms of bringing those guys back or not. And if it's going to be a decision that you are going to just lose a selection, like, that's not ideal unless you are able to bring someone else better with that cap space. So it's just, I want to put all of that into consideration, and in that sense I think the only team that makes sense in the first half of the lottery is Denver for me. In the first half of the first round is Denver for me.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you brought up, as far as, this is what I struggle with all the time, trying to optimize players in a certain space or judging like best player available at a selection. But I do think there is intersection, of course. Like, some players are the best player available in certain schemes, especially that's if you group in like tiers, that makes a lot of sense. I get the skepticism with OG. His shot is, you know, it's far away, and he really needs that to be any kind of an offensive fixture. But I just look at him personally and say, you know, he could be a top five perimeter defender in the league. And at some point in this draft, I just think that he's worth the dice roll. I could see him going. I mean, Denver would be the optimal fit, right? Like, they need perimeter defense so bad, and he's not the same kind of level as Isaac. We'll talk about Denver probably the next episode, because I think they're really intriguing as far as a trade-up candidate if they can maneuver around. They have the pieces and they have the franchise fixture. But let's wrap it up, just to keep this somewhat short. We have a little bit more to get to with the Pistons at 12, the Nuggets at 13, and then Miami at 14. We can probably go down a little bit further as far as just providing quick reactions, maybe some sleeper candidates we like in the...
Yeah, or talk about the teams that have multiple picks, like Portland or Utah or stuff like that, which guys could be a good option if you are entertaining a trade there as well. I think that's interesting if we cover it a little bit as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And so we'll probably end up doing that and then talking about big boards pre-draft on Thursday when you do our live draft show. So please tune into that. We'll have a large group on YouTube. Again, Javier, do you have anything you want to plug? I know you're working on your big board. Are you going to publish that on Twitter or on Ode to Odin?
Yeah, I'm going to probably be done with it. Like, I will guess like right after the draft. Like, I'm just like quite late with everything always. So it will probably get out on the very same day of the draft, I will guess. And yeah, my plan is to have him up, Ode to Odin, in Son's website. He's been kind enough to let me put it up. And I'm just like through it half the way, the lottery, and I have like too many words already. So I don't know if I'm going to trim it down or just put it like it is, because who cares? Eventually, I don't think anybody is going to read it. So it's just to be able to reflect on where my thoughts were and be able to just have like some type of barren to criticize myself, or like at least be consistent with my picks down the road in the next few years. I think that's an interesting exercise, at least.
Definitely. I am almost done with my top seven that I'm going to try to publish by tonight or tomorrow morning. It's already at 10,000 words, so I'm treading on like water here, man. It's pretty brutal, but it might be worth the read. We'll see. I'm going to have a piece on Malik Monk out for the Step Back this week, talking about, you know, his shooting and putting it in context, what kind of player he can be. That's kind of our last draft profile that's of the higher first round guys that the Step Back hasn't gotten to. So look for that. And again, please rate and review on iTunes, and stay tuned for the live draft show again on Thursday. We're probably going to get started. Yeah. Maybe 30 minutes to 45 minutes before, go over our big boards. We'll have Ode to Odin maestro Sean Darenthal with us. We'll see if Mark joins us with his Sixers fandom. Now that we know that Fultz is going to go one, he might be more inclined.
In a party mood, yeah, for sure.
There's less suspect action there at three, potentially. So,
hey, they have 4 second rounders, so they can use like stats all the 3 and D prospects on the board by that time. But like, maybe that's the thing, and he doesn't even care about it, because that's more or less what Colangelo did last year with Kormas and Luau, right? Like, you pick the best wings that he thought were available. So if that's the case, maybe there is not that much intrigue down there in the second round, even for a Sixer fan. So we'll see. I guess, I mean, it would be nice to have him. I hope he's there at least for the quick party reaction, or even like the just being ecstatic about it, like really happy and all that. But we'll see. At least we will have Sean, and he's a better host than both of us, so he will definitely probably take the reins a little bit there. And we almost forgot about saying, like, he's going to be a pretty much an almighty baller show there for us. But this podcast is brought to you by them as well, so just thanks to the network, and please check all the other episodes down there. I've been in on the NBA beat there in a podcast, like not with some, but like a simultaneous episode. We came out at the, same time about some quick hits about the draft, some quick questions. It's, I think it's a whole 1 hour between Son and me, but we are in a separate sense. We are not being talk at the same time, but like that would be another one that I could plug right now before we go.
Yeah, I got to check that out. I haven't gotten to it yet. I've been on like 100 podcasts recently, so I can't keep track of that stuff. So look for that. Yeah. I'm going to do a couple quick hitters with the Chicago Bulls Locked On Network, and then with my friend Dave DeFore, who writes for B-Ball Breakdown. So check that out. And yeah, that was a hell of a exit, actually. That's probably our best work, Javier. So let's get out of here.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.